From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When historians paint the United States in its greatest glory, they conjure up the image of the city shining on a hill. Our guest tonight looked closer, and in that city, he saw a nation of hustlers. America has always been the land of the fast-talking, fast-thinking, quick-fingered conniver. The full freedom to hustle others and to hustle ourselves may be a singular quality of Americans. It gave us get-rich-quick schemes, land grabs, gold rushes, and maybe the dot-com boom. It also gave us the sweeping goals of the pursuit of happiness and sparkling visions like the American dream. Above all, our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Walter McDougall, says that a history of hustling gave America, from the moment of its inception, a great and hungry heart. In a magnificent new history, Walter McDougall reminds us that America was not just born of revolution, it is one, and a revolution that hustles. Tonight on Point, America the Hustler and a new look at the history of the United States. When you look out on the landscape of American history, do you see both hustle and hustlers, hornswogglers and hoodwinkers fueling great and shady accomplishments? Are we still hustling and being hustled? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, is Walter McDougall, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, the first in a three-part series on the history of the United States, is the tremendously written and deeply considered Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History, 1585 to 1828. Good evening and welcome, Walter McDougall.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and honor. And in the spirit of the candor of the book, it's also good publicity to be on your show.
Good. Candor all the way, I say, but it is much deserved publicity, and I hope a lot of people read this book. It's stupendous. I want to welcome also from Hanover, New Hampshire, our On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Candor compels me to tell our listeners what they would otherwise not guess, that I'm paid for this.
There you go. We're paid, but we're reading, and we're candid, and gosh, what a magnificent new view. Just terrific, Walter McDougall. I've got to ask you right off the bat, because we referred to it introducing you tonight, the Bob Dylan connection to the title of your book, Freedom Just Around the Corner. Spell it out so the mystery is solved.
I'm a big Bob Dylan fan, and I just contemplating the early history of the United States, the origins of our country, the colonial period. For some reason, this wonderful song, Joker Man, came into my mind. It's one of Dylan's great epics, and it's very ironic. I encourage your readers to punch it up on a website if they don't know the Dylan song. He says, for instance, you were born with a snake in both of your fists while a hurricane was blowing. Mm. Oh, that's a creepy image.
Yes.
But it dawned on me that, guess what? Our first artistic depiction of the 13 colonies coming together was Benjamin Franklin's political cartoon, Join or Die, in which he depicted a snake cut into 13 parts and had to come together or it would be crushed.
1754, and
right.
the sort of tongue scroll coming out of the snake's mouth says, join or die, and then the subtle message from the snake's mouth?
Unite and conquer.
the promise of America. And, of course, the other snake in the fist, liberty or death, don't tread on me. And this is not from New Hampshire, but preceding that.
That's essentially our first American battle flag. It was the Culpeper flag. It was adopted by colonial militia units and naval vessels throughout the colonies until, of course, the Stars and Stripes was designed.
But the key line from the Dylan song Joker Man that you've used for your title here, freedom just around the corner for you, but with truth so far off, what good will it do? And there you begin to get at the hustle that you say is not just a hustle of others, but sometimes Americans hustling themselves. Walter McDougall, I should be clear about this. This is a real history, 1585 to 1828, and it gives the entire sweep, and it's got all the grain and detail of the full history, but it's got a thread pulled through it that I hope you'll begin to illuminate for us. You write about at the very beginning about some great American novels and what they point at, and especially you're looking here at Herman Melville, and you cite his book Confidence Man, but also his view of the American character in general. You say the new man, this American, as Melville would certainly have had it, he or she is a hustler. What do you mean by that, Walter McDougall?
I mean that in both the positive and the negative senses of the term. Americans have always been builders, go-getters, strivers, doers, explorers, pioneers, all the normal ways we think about this great land of opportunity and the vigorous immigrant populations that populated and made it the greatest nation on God's green earth, to quote another radio personality. But at the same time, I also mean it in the sense that many, perhaps most Americans, also consciously or unconsciously, have been hustlers in the sort of darker side of its meaning. Americans have been scofflaws. Americans have been geniuses at figuring out ways to get around or simply ignore any restrictions, laws, monopolies, external authorities that get in the way of our pursuit of happiness.
And you're not just talking free spirits there. You cite the American English being, as you say, being uniquely endowed with words connoting a swindle. And the kind of words you're stacking up behind this are bait, bamboozle, bilk, bite, blackmail, blindside, blow smoke, bluff, buffalo, chisel, clip, collude, con. I mean, right on. Diddle, dupe, fleece, fob, foist, hook, hose, hustle. You're talking about down and dirty hustle here.
Hey, we're a free country. Corruption is one of the proofs that a nation of people is free. Sad to say, but that's it. What the real bottom line here is that the American people, because of geography, obviously, being an ocean away from European authorities, being on a continent where they had no major rivals, particularly after the French were defeated, the American people were freer to express the whole panoply of human nature than any other people in the history of the world. Consequently, Americans have been supremely generous, idealistic, outgoing, and yet at the same time, many Americans have also indulged in the sort of the darker side of human nature, very often exploiting each other, and certainly exploiting, obviously, enslaved Africans, Indians, and the rest. But here's the real, I think, the key to the point I'm trying to make in this book, and that is American corruption, if you want to call it that, this hustling quality, has very often been tremendously creative. Creative corruption. This is an idea that I first imagined in an earlier book when I was writing about the Transcontinental Railroad.
So not Schumpeter's creative destruction, but creative corruption.
Creative corruption. Everyone knows the story of the Transcontinental Railroad, the four robber barons, Leland Stanford and the rest, and how they made fortunes sort of bilking Congress and doing huge land deals and manipulating the politics of California and all the rest. Yeah, that's true. All that is true. But they built the railroad. They built the railroad more quickly than anyone imagined. And doggone it, if they didn't tie this nation coast to coast together and make a tremendous contribution to the common good, to the common weal of the United States.
So the hustlers themselves, the scam, the flim-flam, the fob, the foist, on all the rest, the fleece even, you're saying was actually fuel to the dynamism that's so celebrated in the United States?
In many cases. But you see, we are a democracy. This is our wonderful check. The American people are willing to turn a blind eye to massive corruption in high places so long as they can perceive that things are getting done in the public good. A mayor of a city might be very corrupt. He might run a machine. There might be graft and kickbacks going on all the time. But doggone it, if the economy is healthy, if buildings are going up, bridges are being built, trash is being hauled away, the people are willing to forgive that. If, on the other hand, public theft or corruption is going on without those public goods being created, then the voters eventually will get angry and throw them out. The British regime in the 13 colonies was a very light yoke, very light. Oh, stamp acts, tea acts, intolerable acts. You put them all together, and they really did not interfere very much with the American life and with American opportunities. They were very light. They were perceived as uncreatively corrupt, and the 13 colonies got themselves into a high moral dungeon about it. More power to them. God bless them. They created this country. The real key to this hustler theme is whether the corruption, and I won't name any names because I don't want to get sued, but you can look around the country today from Boston to L.A. and you can probably name a dozen people that you think ought to be in jail.
Famously, the kind of Enron, Tyco, and right on down that's so
right.
Much in the news.
The Enrons are they're thieves. Who were stealing essentially from widows and orphans. That corruption was utterly uncreative. But if some other energy company sort of got around federal regulations, bribed a few foreign officials, sort of had a state legislature in their pocket, maybe the Texas Railway Commission that runs the oil industry down there, and managed to dig a lot of new oil that drove the price of gas down, the American people wouldn't mind that at all.
Jack Beatty, join us here. Walter McDougall came in with his really wonderful new history, Freedom Just Around the Corner, and he says right in the preface that he set out not to be a condemning history or a celebrating history. He looked for a theme to run through all this, and he found this hustle. We'll talk about, as he does, how Americans hustled themselves in the kind of metaphysics here. But he's simply looking at the straight-up kind of hornswoggle hustle and say, you know what, on balance, this probably worked for this country.
Yeah, and it goes right back to the beginning. I mean, to read the annals of the Virginia Company, for example, is to be introduced to a world of a really almost fatal chicane. Two of the great minds of the century, Francis Bacon and very possibly William Shakespeare, were lured in to buy a stock in this enterprise. The thing from its founding up until its dissolution in 1625, it spent over £100,000 without either return or of profit or principle. It was sold by poets like Michael Drayton, who wrote, "When nature hath in store fowl, fish, and venison of without your toil," and so on. And it was, and of course the reality was that people were starving. They were eating their boots. And in Eastwood Ho, Ben Jonson sends this up wonderfully. He's got a scene in a tavern where Captain Seagull is enthralling the tars with his stories about Virginia, and he says, "Virginia, it's a paradise washed by waves of rubies and diamonds where even the chamber pots are pure gold." Now, there's the sell for you.
That is the sell. And all this to pull the shekels out of people's pockets for a sort of pie-in-the-sky land operation in the New World.
Every colony, particularly the ones that had companies or proprietors behind them, began as a gigantic land speculation. Was William Penn an idealistic Quaker? Yes, he was. Were the Puritans, John Winthrop, and the rest? Certainly, they were. But hey, there was more to it than that. John Winthrop Jr., in fact, was one of my favorite hustlers. He was, in a sense, the real proto-American, the son of the founder of the Puritan Commonwealth. He couldn't stand still. He was founding new towns everywhere. He's speculating in land. He went back to Europe to learn science and medicine because he knew the New England colonies needed that knowledge. Brought it back. Became a governor of Connecticut. Massachusetts Assembly, the General Court, had passed a law.
Walter McDougall, hold the story. We've got to take a short break. I'm sure we have plenty of stories, so we want to hear them. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize winner Walter McDougall about his new history, Freedom, Just Around the Corner. He takes the line from Bob Dylan's 1983 song Joker Man from the album Infidels. Let's listen to a little bit of that right now as we go into a break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Standing on the water, casting your bread, while the eyes of the idol with the iron head are glowing. Distant ships sailing into the mist. You were born with a snake in both of your fists while a hurricane was blowing. Freedom, just around the corner for you. But with truth so far off, what good will it do? Joker man danced to the nightingale tune.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new American history of American hustle and Americans as hustlers, Americans as a nation of rogues on the make, people seeking the main chance. Our guest tonight is the author of a new history called Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History, 1585 to 1828. It's Walter McDougall, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Are you ready for a new take on the heart of the American character? Do you buy Walter McDougall's focus on Americans as fast talkers, bamboozlers, grifters, hustlers? Are you prepared to accept a legacy of con men and hucksters who built a great nation? Walter McDougall, we should say that you make no bones about being very fond of this nation of hustlers, and you make some very large claims for the significance of that nation, of the United States. I wonder if you'd be good enough to read just a little bit from the book, maybe just the first paragraph of your preface there, to put in context just how big a deal you see this nation's birth as being.
All right. I underscore your remark about loving this country. That's one of the reasons why I ended up accepting this impossible assignment. I fell in love with the United States of America.
And 600 pages later, we're getting the fruit of that, and we thank you for it. But let's hear a little bit.
Okay. All right, here's the beginning. The creation of the United States of America is the central event of the past 400 years. If some ghostly ship, some flying Dutchman, were transported in time from the year 1600 to the present, the crew would be amazed by our technology and the sheer numbers of people on the globe, but the array of civilizations would be recognizable. There is today, as there was then, a huge Chinese empire run by an authoritarian but beleaguered bureaucracy, a homogeneous, anxious, suspicious Japan, a teeming, crazy quilt of Hindus and Muslims in India attempting to make a state of themselves, an amorphous Russian empire pulsing outward and inward in proportion to Muscovy's projection of force, a vast Islamic crescent hostile to infidels but beset by rival centers of power, a dynamic, more or less Christian civilization in Europe aspiring to unity but vexed by its dense congeries of nations and tongues, and finally an Iberian Amerindian culture in South America marked by relative poverty and strategic impotence. The only continent that would astound the Renaissance time travelers would be North America, which was primitive and nearly vacant as late as 1607, but which today hosts the mightiest, richest, most dynamic civilization in history, a civilization, moreover, that perturbs the trajectories of all other civilizations just by existing.
Walter McDougall, reading from his new American history, Freedom Just Around the Corner. Let me ask you about the time frame that you've grabbed in this book, 1585 to 1828. I know this is intended to be the first of three, but how did you choose these dates? What are the pivot moments that you're looking at there?
I ran out of space.
So you got to Jackson and fell down.
This Harper, can I mention the publisher?
Sure.
HarperCollins expected me and wanted me to write a giant, fat, one-volume history of the United States, coming all the way down to the present, hopefully in less than 1,000 pages. After I'd written 500 pages and only gotten up to the 19th century, I realized I wasn't going to make it. So I asked them if it was okay to do a multi-volume series, and they readily agreed to that. And I chose 1828 as the stopping point for a number of reasons. I won't trouble you with all of them. One is it's the beginning of the railroad era, mm-hmm. and the beginning of the era of Jacksonian democracy. 1828 is sort of the culmination of the early period in the development of American politics, with the election of Andrew Jackson, and if I may throw in humor is one of the things I wanted to get back into American history. Historians, whether they are celebratory or critical of the of our history, tend to take us so seriously.
Well, you don't fall in that trap. I'm looking right here. You've got Jackson coming to town.
So many delightful, yeah. Humorous aspects to our culture, and indeed our perhaps sometimes self-delusion. But here's the point about Jackson.
Yeah.
What Americans learned about their politics in 1828 was what they were really for. There had been, why are we a free people? Why did we draft the Constitution? Why do we strive for democracy? There was talk of empires of liberty and Republican virtue and manifest destiny. But with Andrew Jackson's election, Americans discovered the purpose of their politics is to win elections.
And having won them, to live as they would. You've got this wonderful kind of footnote there. As the Jackson horde came to town, wondrous it was, and to the genteel a nightmare. Washington, Franklin, Madison, Hamilton, Adams, and Jefferson had imagined the American experience coming to all sorts of bad ends. They never imagined the federal city overrun by frontiersmen who cared nothing for history and loved only cheap land and credit, whiskey, tobacco, guns, fast women, fast horses, and Jesus, not necessarily in that order. There it is, Jack. Andrew Jackson comes to town. Jack Beatty, I know that you've got more tales of this wonderful American penchant for shenanigans up your sleeve.
Well, actually, yeah, I'm working on a book on American hustling in the latter part of the 19th century, and I've come across a wonderful character. Our historian no doubt knows him, William B. Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of the archetype of the hustler in both senses. And with him, as with these other characters, there is a kind of civic residuum. That is, all the hustling led to something. To put it shortly, as the painter Guizot said about him, he built because he owned Chicago. Ogden arrived in Chicago in the late 1830s, a young guy from New York State, and got involved in land speculation, lost a fortune, and then in the 40s decided to save the farmers of northern Illinois from the mud and to build a railroad from Chicago to Galena, the Chicago-Galena Railroad, the first railroad connecting Chicago. Easterners wouldn't give him any money for it. So in the dry season, because there was only a spell there where you could even drive, you know, ride out into these mud areas, he rode from house to house raising money, selling stock subscriptions. And while he was at it, he sold plows for John Deere. Finally, he gets his money together. He gets he orders a locomotive called Pioneer from the Michigan Southern. It comes across the lake. It's unloaded in Chicago. 20,000 people gather to see it towed across the street. While it's being towed across town, he's taking advantage of the crowd, selling the last of the subscriptions. Okay, they lay out the route for the railroad, and lo and behold, the Kinzie Street Terminal just happens to be on property he owns, in a neighborhood where he owns all the, and it wouldn't you know, but the timber used for all the tracks, you know, he owns that lumber concession.
Of course.
Isn't this just entrepreneurship on the grand scale, Jack?
Absolutely. And it's, and he went on to parlay this into, you know, the Chicago and Northwestern. He got onto naturally he got into the Union Pacific. But in 1866, a sensational pamphlet was written exposing him. And here's just some of the title. This is the pamphlet: Manual for the Instruction of Rings, Railroads, and Political, with a history of the Grand Chicago and Northwestern Ring and the secret of its success in placing an overissue of 20 millions with a margin of 3 millions in 3 years. That's the title. And in this pamphlet, Ogden is the grand concoctor of the scheme, accused of watering the stock. Well, the Chicago Republican replied, "Wall Street is not looking after moralists, but after grand concoctors."
Grand concoctors.
And his house, which took a city block in Chicago, why not? He sort of built the city. There was something left. Some social deposit, a civic, his avarice was a civic asset.
Walter McDougall, is that the kind of example that you're thinking of in earlier years?
Yes, I am. Did Ogden ever hire a young railroad attorney in Illinois named Abraham Lincoln?
He sure did.
That's what I thought.
He sure did.
Lincoln, great man, our greatest, perhaps, the high priest of our civil religion. But heck, he was a railroad lawyer. He did deals in the legislature, and he was the one who moved the capital to Springfield as a horse trade in order to get enough votes in the legislature to put through a public works, big public works bill that he had, which was going to benefit his railroad clients.
So plenty of shenanigans, even in the hands of the great one. Walter McDougall, Jack, stand by. A lot of people want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. We're talking about this new vision of America, the American hustler tonight. What do you make of it? Michael's calling from Detroit. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment to tell you what I think of it. I want the comments directed towards the first speaker. First of all, the speaker kept referring to two things. He was saying, one, that America is the greatest country and the richest and most powerful country in the history of the world. First of all, he doesn't know that. It doesn't matter how much history you've read, you don't know the history of the world. Second of all, the idea of rich, mighty, and powerful is relative to what you consider to be worth having. And the second thing that you keep associating with those comments is the fact that America is about hustlers. We're all hustlers, scam artists. And so what you're doing is you're creating an association that greatness is involved with scamming. And I'm not denying that that may be the case and that there's great scam artists, but what I feel is an underlying comment to this entire conversation is we're talking about the leaders of our world right now and the con that they're pulling on everybody right now. And I think that it's a terrible mistake, though I love and appreciate your humor very much, to take what they're doing lightly. Because it's not that the guy who stole everyone's money in California and built a railroad from the east to west coast, how do you know he did great things? All he did was make more fiscal money, but how many people benefited? How many people suffered? Those are the questions. I mean, you know, I love your humor, and I hate to be a downer in this conversation because you guys have a really light heart. But this is serious stuff, and it's happening right now. People are getting scammed right now.
It is serious stuff, Michael. But I'm glad you raised this because this really is the other side of the equation. And Walter McDougall, you know that most Americans hearing your thesis are going to want to hear you answer this as well. Is this really a celebratable face of the United States? Because, of course, all these scams, and you point to the big ones, the big hustles on the American Indians, on African-American slaves, had major victims. So how do you do the math on this, Michael's asking?
Well, I'm not in the business of playing God. And I'm not celebrating it. I'm merely describing it. I did not set out on this project with this hustler theme in mind at all. I wrote a long prospectus for my publisher with about six or eight major themes that I hope to develop in this book, and they're all in there. The hustler theme is only one of many that I think are quite worthwhile, including ones that have a lot to do with American religiosity, spirituality, mm-hmm. And so forth. But this, obviously, this particular theme has really caught a lot of interest, and I received a very positive review in the New York Times, for which I'm very grateful, from an outstanding historian.
From Gordon Wood. But he raises a question
He sort of did the same thing he suggests that I do, overemphasizing the hustler theme.
But he asked a question that's so close to Michael's that let's just pick it up. This from Gordon Wood's review in the Times. He concludes saying, when he, that is you, Walter McDougall, says such things as, whatever triumphs in a democracy is by definition democratic, he turns our values and institutions into little more than illusions that we use to hide the sordid reality of our persistent hustling. That, he writes, seems to be carrying realism and candor a bit too far. What do you say?
Maybe it is, but a case can be made. A case can indeed be made that the American people are geniuses also at self-delusion. This is human nature in the raw. This is the penchant of a free people to turn a blind eye to things that get in the way of their pursuit of happiness. If it is living with the reality of slavery, under the Constitution of the United States of America, people will live with the reality of slavery for some, 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
If it is allowing robber barons to stock job and dip into the public purse and buy politicians, so long as it's not hurting me, and perhaps so long as it looks like good things are being done through that operation, then we turn a blind eye to it. And by the same token, Americans want to do, what all people want to do, but Americans are free to do it, is to feel good about doing well. You see, there's the moral side of it. We want to do well. This is a land of opportunity. Everyone wants to improve themselves, have a great career, pursue happiness in whatever way they think will make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
They find out that they're not really all that happy, and they try to persuade themselves that they are, or that some other marketed boon, whether it's a nose job or a new car or whatever,
or snake oil,
that will make them happy, and we are engaged in a kind of a grand process of self-delusion.
Now this hustle, the hustle of the selves, at one point...
The belief that American foreign policy is always idealistic and moral is a very powerful myth.
Yes.
Is it real? No, of course not. American foreign policy is good, bad, and ugly.
And it keeps the country rolling, sometimes in a direction we may look back on with pride, and other times not. But you go even deeper at one point. You say, again, talking about Herman Melville, you say Melville took the risk of telling the truth, as he saw it, about the tricks Americans played on themselves in their effort to worship both God and mammon. Is that the core self-hustle of American society?
This is the, yes. Most of our national traits originated in the British Isles. Now, every other immigrant group has made tremendous contributions, and that's one of my goals in the book, is to give more attention to the German Americans, Irish Americans, Jewish Americans, Italian Americans, etc., as well as Native Americans and Africans. But our core values came from Britain in the 17th and 18th centuries, a product of the Reformation and the Enlightenment and the capitalist revolution in the country, England, that was the first to establish a genuinely capitalist economic order, not just merchants sailing around the world, but rural capitalism, the national market, a marketplace of everything, including religion, values, culture. And the first preachers in the revivals in the colonies in the so-called First Great Awakening had themselves learned to market religion the way that merchants marketed China, perfume, tobacco. And so the evangelical style of American religion is also drawn out of this sort of hustling, market-oriented, capitalist mode.
And there's also the picture that you paint of this rather religion-oriented people looking out on this enormous land of enormous opportunity and having trouble keeping their hunger, their greed for that opportunity lining up with their religious precepts.
That's right. George Whitefield, the greatest of the preachers in the First Great Awakening, he was very influenced by the Wesleys, the Methodists. He was a very devout man. He devoted his entire life to preaching the gospel. He went up and down the colonies dozens of times, preached something like 20,000 sermons, and he was genuine. He was devout. He wasn't pocketing the money and running off. He wasn't a phony baloney preacher like some of the ones we have. But nevertheless, he domesticated Protestant evangelicalism to the American scene. He blessed slavery. He blessed alcohol.
Walter McDougall, hold it there for just a moment.
We've
got to take a break. It's not history, but it's a break. We're talking about a new American history with Walter McDougall, author of the new book, Freedom, Just Around the Corner. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new American history of American hustle and Americans as hustlers, Americans as a nation of rogues on the make, people seeking the main chance. Our guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Walter McDougall. His new history from 1585 to 1828 is Freedom, Just Around the Corner. You can join this conversation. Do Americans hustle themselves to stay with the program, to keep buying the dream? And if true freedom remains just around the corner, to use Bob Dylan's phrase in this book's title, is freedom itself a hustle? Or is it the fundamental fuel? Are we still hustling and being hustled? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Peter's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks so much for taking my call. Sure. I was curious about one thing. I'm an American citizen, but I spend a lot of time in Canada, and I've become essentially pretty socially and politically Canadian. So I was very curious in this, and you sort of touched on it. The states, and your date was 1828, where your book stopped. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Four things seem to have really come into play in the states that didn't in a lot of other places, and that was, of course, religion, as you mentioned, secession, slavery, and then the Civil War. and where you had just all sorts of things going on. And then I also was thinking, of course, of Sinclair Lewis's book, Elmer Gantry, which was a scam at almost every level. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were about that, and I'd love the answer off the air, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter. Walter McDougall.
Canadian. He's become a Canadian by, in terms, what did he say? By
culturally, so, yes.
Culturally
Canadian and socially.
But an American citizen.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a Tory.
Why do you say so?
Well, many of the American Tories in the colonies, of course, had to relocate.
Went north, yep.
To Canada, and it's been a comparison has been made by Brits that I've talked to that essentially the United States of America is a creation of 18th century Whigs, and the residual is Canada, which was a creation of 19th century Tories. Of course, most Canadians now are far to the left of the old Tories. I don't mean it that way, but the mentality was one of far more respect for authority, respect for the crown, respect for parliament, a more law-abiding mentality among the Canadians, more communal, whereas the Americans to the south had no truck with respecting authority. The whole point of America was to get away from authority and to get around it.
So in a way, here's the contrast that highlights the American profile. Peter spoke to these issues of slavery and civil war. You began, in some sense, to describe slavery itself as a kind of, a kind of hustle, certainly of the slaves, but also of the country as it, rationalized this. So is the Civil War one of the costs of a hustle, the resolution, the price of working through a hustle?
The Civil War, gosh, I can't sum it up in one sentence, but the Civil War, the great crisis of the whole American enterprise, was the price the nation paid for turning a blind eye to the poison that was injected into the nation at the very beginning. But heck, there was a continent out there to win. There were fortunes to be made. There were children to care for, frontiers to develop. The American people were in too big a hurry to put all that to one side while they perhaps fought out the slavery issue at the beginning. Well, we'll solve that some other time. Let the next generation worry about that problem. Someday slavery will wither away or what have you. Meanwhile, there's a continent out there to develop. And so what happened essentially was that the American people, North and South, entered into a conspiracy of silence.
And there
it was written into the rules of Congress. Now, that conspiracy of silence was rudely broken in 1820, over the issue of the statehood of Missouri and whether Missouri would enter the Union as a slave state or not. And all of a sudden, people in Congress began to say hideous, hideous things to each other that weren't supposed to be said, things like slavery is morally wrong. Slavery is of the devil, forcing the Southerners in turn to go to the other extreme and to make the case that slavery was a positive good and that the Northern factory owners and whatnot were actually more cruel to their workers than were plantation owners. And all of a sudden, as I say, Americans were on the verge of civil war because they broke their conspiracy of silence.
And so this hustle got named and framed, and off the country went to
war. That's right. And Henry Clay, the great compromiser, was able to put together the package that sort of got the Missouri problem done and put to one side in the Missouri Compromise. Congress and the American people then went back to sleep for another generation.
Walter McDougall, we've only got a few minutes left, and I have to try and bring this up to the present just a little bit. And I know historians are loath to do that, and yet I'm sure it'll be on many people's minds. The United States now as the superpower, the unipolar power. What about the hustler nation as world leader, or as you put it, world revolutionary? As I recall, there's some place in the book where you talk about how, to the Europeans, the unleashed human hungers and appetites were seen as death for social order, and yet here was this whole country built on that. Now we see that same kind of impulse maybe coming into conflict with Islam. When you look at this almost rogue nation, or certainly a nation of rogues that you've described, and now see it as the world power, how does this work?
It doesn't work very well at all.
Why not?
The United States is not set up. The United States government is not set up institutionally to be an imperial power. Whether you use imperial in just in the sense of having great influence or actually formal control overseas, our government is not set up for that. Our government is purposely set up to be as inefficient as possible.
By design, by charter, by the Constitution.
That was Alexander Hamilton, among others, James Madison's genius. Hamilton knew that we were a nation of hustlers. He wanted to tap that individual striving and ambition of people so that it could redound to the benefit of the nation as a whole. So-called idealists like Tom Jefferson and John Adams abominated that viewpoint. They assumed that people would become virtuous and so forth and so on. Jefferson, of course, was a hustler himself, but he was an idealist. Hamilton looked at human nature square in the eye and said, we've got to design a system where the hustling instincts of people can serve individual good and perhaps the public good, but won't do too much public harm.
But here we have facts on the ground, a phrase we heard recently, where the United States is the power. It is attempting to be the leader with that character.
When the 20th century comes around and we grow into a world power simply by our success as a nation and begin to have great interests overseas, now we've got a problem. How are we going to put a good face on America's role in the world? Well, you reach back to the idealism. And and the idea of America as this sort of event, this promised land with a God-given mission to the human race, and then you project that onto your foreign policy, whether you're hustling or not, that is the image that you project, that of Wilsonian idealism. And again, it's a very powerful myth. A nation that believes in the rightness of its cause is going to be far more effective than a nation that doesn't believe in its cause.
We've got just 1 minute left. Can the American hustle be adopted by the world, or does it have to have that big, bounteous continent to start with?
The Chinese are adopting it right now very effectively. Whether it'll do in their regime remains to be seen.
Well, a nation of hustlers, a nation of revolutionaries, a nation that built something big that everybody, including itself, is still dealing with. And what a telling of it, Walter McDougall. I want to thank you very much for coming on tonight. It's been wonderful having you.
Can I have 5 seconds?
Yes, take them.
Don't take my word for it. Read the 3-hour speech Edmund Burke delivered to Parliament in 1775, trying to persuade Parliament not to impose force on the 13 colonies. Among his reasons were, the American people are full of chicane.
He named it and framed it early on right there. Walter McDougall, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot. It was a great pleasure.
Walter McDougall, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of the new book, Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History, 1585 to 1828. In a moment, a lesson in American history from participants in PBS's Colonial House. This is On Point. One year ago, the Voorhees family of Beverly, Massachusetts, embarked on a 4.5-month journey through time. John Voorhees, his wife Michelle, and their then 11-year-old son Giacomo gave up their 21st-century comforts and joined 23 others as colonists in a small 1628 New England town. For PBS's Colonial House series, which concluded last week, from eating muskrat to using leaves for toilet paper to enduring strict laws against swearing, the family learned firsthand that colonial life was not always as it is portrayed in the history books. In this radio diary, John Voorhees and Michelle Rossi Voorhees recall the most difficult part of their 4.5 months on Colonial House.
When we first got there, the learning curve was really steep, and we didn't know how to make a fire or cook the food or make it edible, or we didn't know how to do anything. And we had been trained, but it's different when you're dropped in the midst of it and said, okay, now figure it out. And so it was a couple of weeks before we physically were capable of keeping ourselves fed and warm and dry and all of that. And then once we figured that out, then we visited the society part of it, the laws and the morality and all of that.
We're a pretty hardy family. We were able to handle all of the physical stuff, but getting into the mindset of the 17th century, that's when it became difficult. Where do you draw the line between your personal beliefs and getting into the mindset of those people?
For those of us who didn't believe in the Christian God, it became very uncomfortable. So we quite often did not go to the second part of the Sabbath services and consequently were punished for it. We had to wear a scarlet letter, a D, for in the time it would have been dissenters, but our governor labeled it dissembling. And the first offense, you wore a letter for 24 hours and were confined to stocks, quote-unquote. We didn't have stocks, so you had to either, you had to choose a place, sit in a chair, stand on a rock, whatever, for 2 hours with no communication from anybody. The Puritans or the Pilgrims or the early colonists only wearing black with big wide collars and big buckled shoes was a myth. That's what I thought we would be wearing. We had brightly colored clothes. Nobody had buckles on anything. That was different. And also people thinking that they were very dour and didn't have fun. You know, there was lots of music and singing and drinking and smoking and, you know, they were a body, body bunch. Those are two things that come to mind for me growing up in Massachusetts and, of course, knowing all about the witch trials, and you just kind of are steeped in the history living in this area. And also the idea that the colonists and the Indians got along so well their first year here and celebrated together. That, of course, is another myth that was not true.
There are a lot of things that would have had to happen for us to survive further than we did.
I don't think we could have made it. I don't know. I don't know how many of us would have made it through the winter. Those living conditions were pretty serious, and those people had to have been incredibly hardy, strong human beings, because the clothing that they had, unless they had different clothing and footwear than we were provided with, you would have easily gotten frostbite instantly. They never would have lived through a Maine winter. It just wouldn't have happened.
I think people would have lived through. I don't think everybody would have made it. I think that the dynamics of the community would have changed drastically being presented with that type of harsh reality.
But we would have had enough food, and we would have had enough firewood, and we would have had all of those things. We would have had the necessities to make it through a winter, but I don't know if we could have physically dealt with the cold and with the psychological part.
Well, I think we all would have been huddled in one building, probably.
Yeah.
And psychologically is the key to that question.
That
would have been the big factor.
John Voorhees and Michelle Rossi Voorhees were two participants in PBS's Colonial House. The series concluded last week. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Michael Garth and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.